Conversations That Matter is a partner program for the Center for Dialogue at Simon Fraser University. The production of this program is made possible thanks to the support of the following and viewers like you.
Scott Taylor, welcome to Conversations That Matter.
Pleasure to be here.
We're here to talk about Omar Khadr, his life. Was he a terrorist? Was he a victim? Were his human rights trampled upon as a Canadian? But before we do, I'd like to just establish your background a little bit. You served in the Canadian Armed Forces, and you've remained in that community ever since.
Correct, yeah. So it was, I did a basic engagement as an infantry soldier. I took my commando training with the French Army back in the day. We didn't have a JTF-2 back then, so we had individuals who were commando qualified. So I took that on. I was a soldier and special forces trained, and then loved that whole bit of it. But my background originally was in art, so I started a magazine and followed the exploits of the Canadian Forces. I started Esprit de Corps in 1988 at the age of 27 and stayed with it. And wherever they went, I went. And then it began to be, I would branch out from there and say, okay, well, it's no sense just following the troops around in the Balkans. Let's find out what there is outside of these bases. Let's go, you know, go unembedded and find out what the bigger conflict was. And then it led to Iraq, Afghanistan, Libya, et cetera. So, covered a lot of conflict over the last, 29 years.
You've been to Iraq. You were kidnapped or taken hostage.
Yes, that's, it would be a low point, if you would want to put it that, but in terms of the career, it's something you never expect. I mean, I covered it. It was my 20th trip into Iraq, 2004. I've been a seasoned war correspondent, covered the Balkans. And even as a soldier, you always think whatever's going to happen is going to happen to somebody else. Mm-hmm. It's not going to be me. Or I'll just talk my way out of it. I'm a Canadian, not an American, so when these Iraqis find out, everything will be fine. Well, not necessarily the case. And being an ex-soldier, and from a North America, they didn't really define between Canadians and Americans, and I was with a Turkish colleague when that happened. And it turns out, I mean, that group that held us, called Ansar al-Islam, morphed a couple of times into what is now known as Daesh, or ISIS. So these guys... And it was in the city of Talafar, which is a Turkmen enclave, very remote. You don't hardly hear about it in the news, but at this moment right now, it's still in the control of Daesh. It's still a major city in Iraq, which is under the control of these guys.
What took you there?
Reporting. I mean, I'd been in that town. I knew the north of Iraq. I thought I knew it. I mean, I knew the Kurdish factions. I knew different people in different groups, what they were all striving for. And I'm not on one side. So I'm just reporting what this Kurdish group wants, what that Kurdish group wants, what this Turkmen group wanted to do. And very few people ever report or write about the Turkmens of Iraq, and I'd actually written a book about them. So hearing that the Americans were going to go in and make an attack, myself and my Turkish colleague thought we should be there to record, if nothing else, than the collateral damage which always occurred in these attacks. And we could space ourselves in a hospital, which we'd done before. And of course, you see the casualties coming in, and it's fairly safe because nobody in their right mind bombs a hospital, right? So, although that does happen. So anyway, that's what took us there, was to report on the situation. And
so where were you at the point that you wound up becoming a hostage? What were the circumstances there?
We arrived on the edge of this town and thought, okay, well, the American offensive is about to begin, but it looks like it's still under the control of the Iraqi, U.S.-paid Iraqi police, the official police force. And it was at their checkpoint that we were told to get into a car with some masked gunmen, which we assumed were some sort of special forces unit. Our own JTF-2 wear ski masks, and so we thought this is, the policeman is putting us, the police. It wasn't one man, it was a checkpoint.
You didn't realize that they were a hostile group.
They were being very friendly.
Yeah.
And we had a contact from the hospital that I'd met earlier, and that was the intention, was to go and meet with him, get approval and let him know. Everyone knew the attack was coming. And then it turned out we were in with these guys, and they in fact held the town. There was like 1,500 of them. They held the entire city. The Americans had never admitted that. That might have, been good information to have prior to. And I mean, it's changed hands several times, but at the moment, it's still in the hands of these guys. So very fanatical bunch. And they came under attack from the Americans while we were there. That's the other part of the story. We were held by the group under attack from the Americans, who, in later conversations I had with the American commanders, had no idea that there was hostages. We were not being used as human shields for the ammo dump, even though we were on the ammo dump. They didn't know where we were or who we were, so there was no no change in plans. So,
so it becomes clear to you that these are, this is no longer a friendly environment. How were you treated?
I was beaten repeatedly, and each time we were handed over to a different group. I think there was six occasions in the 5 days where I was to be executed. Either it was going to be suddenly, they were taking me out and shoot me, and that was the orders, and then it would be stood down. There was one day where I was sentenced to be beheaded. They had dug the grave, and then myself and another colleague were to be executed at sunset. I mean, and the sun was going down, and then this other group came in, and the whole thing was called off. But I mean, that was probably the longest walk I ever took when they were bringing us to the edge of that pit, and you know, unexpectedly saved. And it wasn't a mind game at all. I mean, these guys were literally saying, "You can't kill this guy. He's our hostage. You don't have the jurisdiction. We're going to kill him." So. You know,
it's not like they were trying to save your life purpose. It's that they wanted to kill
proprietorship,
you.
Proprietorship, yeah. And it was just the guy, they found some other guy had come in while they were absent, and he was going to execute me. And then he came back and said, "Hey, hold your horses. He's our guy. And he's got to go see the emir first, and this has got to happen." So it was sort of a Daesh's version of bureaucracy. You can't kill him. He's not in your department. He's not your waiter sort of thing. So it came down to that. So it saved my life, but...
Okay, I'm trying to imagine what it would be like to go through that psychologically and emotionally.
Well, once my Turkish colleague was released, she was allowed to go, and I was told I'm to be executed. And I realized that on the calendar, it's now September 11th, 2004. It's the anniversary of, and I'm in an Al-Qaeda affiliated. I mean, there's no way I'm getting out of here. So what made it actually easier was knowing you're going to die. Not thinking you might, but knowing you're going to die. Then you can retain your own self-respect. So someone says to you, "If you don't eat this dog crap, I'm going to kill you. But if you do, you might live. You'll probably eat the dog crap. But if he says, eat the dog crap, and then I'm going to kill you, you're not going to eat the dog crap. Because the end, there's no longer a threat beyond what they're offering." So that was what made it, actually in the final hours, whatever, that's what made it easier, I guess. Not thinking you might, but knowing you're going to, and then you just come to terms with it, and it's just...
But it didn't happen. Thankfully, you're sitting here. Yeah. What were the things that came together that ultimately led to your release?
Once my Turkish colleague was released, and it was a good day and a half, but she was out, and then they knew where we were. So Turkish intelligence had been looking for her in particular. Her father was well-connected, and they were looking for her, but we were together. So, of course, then when they find her, then they know where I am, and that's when the negotiations began. And to be honest, I mean, we'd both been tortured, myself and her, and she had seen the bloodstains where they dragged me out, and she was told that I was dead. And she had no reason to not believe that. She'd mm-hmm. heard the screams, and she'd heard everything else, and then there was silence, and, you know. So she thought they were negotiating for my body, for the sake of my family. And then suddenly the word came back and said, "No, he's scheduled for execution. He's not dead yet. He's still chained to a bed somewhere in Tel Afar." Or actually, I was in Mosul at that point. So yeah, then it was they were able to convince these guys that in fact I wasn't a spy; I was a journalist. So
the reason that I want to establish your experience is because if anybody in Canada has a reason to say I'm angry at those people, mm-hmm. And I'm angry with anybody who has any attachment whatsoever. I think you have a legitimate case.
I've tried to make that case sometimes to people that think I should be taking a harder line on Qatar. And I'm like, look, if no one here has been tortured and survived, I have. I mean, I suffered the brutality of those guys. And there is differences between them. I mean, there was the fanatics mm-hmm. who would come in and they would take charge. And then there was the guys that they would screw up, or then you'd cover for them or whatever happened, and they would sneak you a drink of water, or they would sneak you a cigarette. Even though I don't smoke, it was a gesture you didn't refuse. It was one of those things where the guys made an effort to come and say, okay.
Right.
They could see the human in me. They would see that was this guy's just...
They embraced our common humanity.
Yeah, and that was where you realized that, okay, they're not all the same.
Right.
And yet, obviously, there were fanatics that my Turkish colleague, who's a Muslim, couldn't understand. The woman in one case was a mother. Mm-hmm. And one of her young boys, I think he was 15, had been killed, and the older brother was alive. And she was beseeching him to get out into the fight to join his brother in heaven.
Wow.
This is the thing, and it's a similar case where the emir, the leader of this group that was holding us, the initial leader, mm-hmm. had promised us we'd be released once they won the fight, which they weren't going to win the fight. So he gets killed, and then we end up in a car traveling in this, when they're escaping from the Americans, we get piled into this convoy and we're pushed out. It was just sheer fluke or fate. It turns out it's the brother of the emir who knew about the promise to set us free. So as soon as I hear he's the brother, obviously I'm a Canadian, I said, sorry for your loss, your brother was killed. And this guy's looking at me like, what are you talking about? Like, my brother was a Mujahideen. He died in battle. He's a martyr. Like, he just won the Super Bowl.
Yeah.
And then there's this guy saying, listen, I'm sorry about your, hear about your brother. It's like, what do you mean? He just,
right.
He's an MVP of the Super Bowl, and you're telling me you're sorry.
Mm-hmm.
And that's where you realize, okay, we have a distinct cultural divide, because that would be something, if your brother was killed in combat, you'd be automatically saying, okay, you know,
yeah.
condolences, right?
You write a blog or a column at the time that Mr. Cotter's negotiated a settlement with the government of Canada, and you say that he was a victim and not a terrorist. And you're going against a tremendous number of people in Canada who are going, he didn't deserve anything, you know, like, to hell with him and his rights, and yet you're saying, no. What compels you to say, we have to accept that Mr. Cotter was mistreated by the Canadian government, and he is due compensation?
Just by looking at the circumstances, I mean, he was 15 at the time. I mean,
yes.
His father had taken him in there. I mean, he was, I mean, a ward of his father, of his parents. I mean, whatever they did or whatever their beliefs were, again, nobody's questioning that his father was an Al-Qaeda operative and he was a
highly
fanatic.
Placed, yes.
So yeah. People, especially at 15, you tend to look up to your dad and do whatever. I mean, you're still under their spell, if you will.
He had no choice to be there. Even though he was born in Canada, he had no choice to be in Afghanistan.
His father is to blame for his upbringing and for the values that he gave him, and he brought him in. And they wouldn't have seen that. I mean, him seeing himself as a fighter, his father was a fighter, his brothers were fighters,
mm-hmm.
And this village gets attacked by American soldiers, and he's there. I mean, and it's he gets wounded. I mean, you've seen the pictures of this. I mean, he's severely wounded.
You have a picture on your blog with two gaping holes in his chest. I don't understand how he survived.
Well, they've talked to the medic since that did save his life, and he thought like it was touch and go, but he's like very proud of the fact that no matter what he's been accused of doing, and they said that he'd thrown a grenade that killed this special forces operative who had medical
those
training.
Those details are a little sketchy, as I
understand. And there's people who think it might have been friendly fire, he might have thrown a grenade back, and others say that he was buried under some soil.
Or that there was another person still alive at the moment that grenade was thrown.
I've heard everything from
right.
it was one of their own grenades and everything. Yeah. So all of that, you know, fog of war. But if people are throwing grenades in a battle, and this, even though they say he was a medic, he was medically trained by these special forces.
Mm-hmm.
So those guys, I mean, when you have a special forces brick of four guys, one is a communication specialist, one is a medical specialist, one is a sniper perhaps, one is... So he would have that specialty, but he wasn't per se, he was operating as a combat soldier that day.
Mm-hmm.
Even the medic that did come along and saved Cotter has said that.
Yeah.
Trained soldiers, professional soldiers in a battle. How can you call that murder?
Well, I mean, because the rules of war apply.
But boy soldiers, I mean, these guys, I mean, we would have treated them differently. We see boy soldiers as victims, and we've got former Senator Romeo Dallaire, former general, going on and on about this, that these mm-hmm. guys themselves, I mean, they would be minors if they were committing crimes in Canada. Why would we give them adult status, especially if it's their parents that are directly bringing them into this?
Right.
And I can always see in Cotter the kid that was guarding me that would sneak me a cigarette or whatever else. I mean, it wasn't mm-hmm. really him. I mean, he was there and he was doing his bit. Peer pressure, parental pressure, whatever. I mean, we all have that.
I've heard a few people say, well, he had a choice. You know, he could have been a conscientious objector. And I think, well, hang on a second. I knew people who were conscientious objectors during the Vietnam War in the United States, where your civil rights were completely different than they are here. And if you didn't sign up and go to war, you went to prison.
Yeah.
So if you can't do it in the United States, how could you do it in Afghanistan in a radicalized environment?
And we didn't blame the Hitler youth, the German Hitler youth that were used in the final days, 12 to 15-year-old boys who were out fighting in the streets of Berlin. The crime then was put on the officials that sent them out. And so they were using these boys. I mean, mm-hmm. they didn't say, well, these are fanatical. They had pictures of Hitler in their home, and they went out and fought for him. And we realized they were too young to have made those decisions in an adult capacity.
They
so why is
the
Cotter suddenly
right.
some superhuman that he's able to do this and he's, you know,
right.
without fault?
So that aside, though, what I go, okay, all of those details, I can't, you know, find my way to the absolute truth. But at the end of that process, the American medic on board that helicopter went to extraordinary lengths to save Omar Khadr's life.
Yeah.
But he then gets introduced into a hell of his own. He's sent to Guantanamo Bay, where he is held for a number of years.
This is where the Canadian government failed.
And this is what I find disturbing, that you hear people go, well, so what? You know, he was an enemy combatant. But the fact of the matter is, he is a Canadian, and rights are extended to all Canadians, whether we like him or not. If you're a Canadian, you have rights that the Canadian government is supposed to uphold.
And even as a combatant, I mean, this whole thing about the illegal combatants was brought in by the George Bush administration after 9/11. And it's like, up until then, I mean, we're all signatories to the Geneva Convention.
Yes.
Hitler Youth fighting were not considered illegal combatants or whatever. I mean, and nobody in Afghanistan wore a uniform. They still don't.
Yeah.
But it doesn't mean they don't consider themselves combatants. I mean, the fact that we're fighting these guys, they should have been the same old name, rank, and serial number. They wouldn't have a serial number, but they might have a rank of sort, and then kept and offered the same things which would be given them. But because they're, as an organization, not themselves signatories to it, we said that then they don't qualify. But then that makes us essentially them. And that's the problem, is that if we throw away our own rules, then we are no longer having the moral high ground. And that's what happened with this young Omar Khadr. I mean, he was taken in, and then we had repeated occasions where his own Marine JAG would come to Canada to plead with the Harper government to ask for his release or his extradition back to Canada. Because other similar prisoners were taken back to, I think it was Britain and Australia. And they kept on falling on deaf ears. But this is a guy, not some, you know, left-wing peace activist. This is a guy who's in a uniform in the States saying this guy, his client, Khadr, cannot get a fair trial.
Mm-hmm.
And he's not allowed. And then when they had, of course,
JAG, of course, is the American
Judge Advocate General. JAG.
Right.
I think everyone watches the TV show, but the Judge Advocate General. So the legal
who is assigned to represent Omar Khadr when he goes to trial.
His own system can't give this man a fair trial. You, as the Canadian government, need to get him out. Otherwise, his rights are being violated. And this is them coming up. So again, not some left wing peace activist. This guy is in uniform. You remember the old "You can't handle the truth." Those guys. I mean, he's in there looking for justice, and they eventually had to sign the confession of murder, which otherwise he wasn't getting out of there. So, I mean, he was tortured, which he was. I mean,
yes.
People say, oh, positional torture is not torture. I've had positional torture. Excruciating. I mean, it's, anybody says that it's not the same. I was tortured and had positional torture. I mean, equally painful. And it's one of those things where do I sign?
I want
force
this
the confession.
Stop. Yeah.
Believe me. So they got that out of him, and now they're of course contesting that. And then you've got the widow of the man who was killed looking for, I forget the exact amount, 120.
Yeah, it's an extraordinary amount of money.
Millions.
Yeah.
And you say that, well, if and they were granted that, they were awarded that in a court, which was uncontested because Omar Khadr wasn't represented.
Yeah.
So you just say, well, this man killed your husband, then you're entitled to 30-something, whatever it is, $1 million. And it's like, well, okay, well, then why wouldn't a Canadian soldier killed in same circumstances be awarded that same amount? Who is it? I mean, why is he worth that much more? Special Forces operative, she would have been given some compensation. But there's no way that Omar Khadr sat up at night plotting the murder of a man he'd never met that in a firefight was killed by a grenade, which is an area weapon.
Mm-hmm.
It's not even a targeted weapon. It's not a pistol or a rifle.
But the essential point here is that the governments of Jean Chrétien and Stephen Harper chose to turn their back on a Canadian citizen. And I think this is where, if we say we're going to stand on the moral high ground and stand up for the values that we believe in, our government can't do that. It can't do it to somebody just because they don't like them.
Or they're afraid of the Americans.
Right.
And at the time, I mean, the Chrétien government was this whole immediate post 9/11 thing where America was like wounded and out looking to reestablish itself. And that was not the moment perhaps to say, you know what, we don't buy into your illegal combatant crap. I mean, that doesn't exist.
Mm-hmm.
He's our guy, release him. You know, there was no oomph on that. But as it went further along and people began to question it, and you had Barack Obama saying we're going to eliminate Guantanamo Bay, and people were questioning all this stuff, and the JAG officer flying to Ottawa saying you need to get your guy out.
Right.
then you start to say, well, why weren't we doing more for this kid? He's no longer a kid, by the way.
No, he's now 30 years of age.
Yeah.
And he spent his entire life in turmoil. Would be an understatement.
Well, I think it was the medic that saved him and said it best when people were questioning the amount of the settlement. And I don't know what you'd ever compensate for that man, what he's been through, and for what he, I mean, how do you put a dollar figure on that? But the guy said, well, who would voluntarily go through what he went through for that amount of money? The answer is zero.
Right.
So it really isn't overcompensation if you would gladly jump at the chance to give up your youth, be tortured, live in Guantanamo Bay, and then at the end of the day, you're going to walk out, you know, having forfeit your youth and be given $10.5 million.
Well, I hope that $10.5 million serves as a reminder to anybody else in government who chooses not to respect the rights of Canadian citizens. Because if you pick and choose a right, then it's not a right.
Well, I mean, other people have questioned also why it is that we're paying this money when, in fact, the people that did the injustice are the Americans. And no one's even daring to say that it should be them compensating him for his lost youth. But us failing to bring him back was a failure of our government, yeah?
That's, I think, another avenue that Mr. Cotter may have a right to pursue. But it's not that is not the Canadian government's responsibility. The Canadian government's responsibility was to ensure that he was given fair access to justice and representation. And they failed to come to his assistance. And this, I think, is the message.
Where it does speak volumes when the Canadian government is saying mea culpa and they're giving $10.5 million to Cotter for not saving him from the Americans.
Yeah.
And what are the Americans guilty of? If just not saving him is worth this much compensation, then you got to say to yourself, well, how bad was it?
Well, I hope that this doesn't happen to another Canadian. Mr. Taylor, thank you very much for coming in and being part of Conversations That Matter.
My pleasure.